If you haven't already, please turn off your mobiles and the rest of it. Thank you for coming, especially the Jake Vanderkamp fan club. We're starting to get busy with speakers again, which is good, and this week is particularly busy. Tomorrow, Nicole Kempton, a expert in China's reform through labor system, will be speaking. I think the announcement said we were holding that in conjunction with the 60th anniversary of China's founding. I didn't write that. And then Martin Jakes from the London School of Economics is going to talk about his very interesting new book, When China Rules the World, on Thursday. And early next month, a very good speaker, Tom Curley, the president and chief executive of Associated Press. Those are the highlights. For today's event, actually, I should probably mention we're probably going to have to schedule a wake for the Far Eastern Economic Review and maybe RTHK as well. And you thought your business was tough, Tony. I'm not going to introduce Jake because you all know Jake. He has been part of the furniture at this club for so long that when Hong Kong's chief executive, Donald Tsang, spoke to us about about heritage preservation in June, you'll remember that he officially designated Jake a Grade 1 bar monument, which basically means that Jake can never be tampered with. We're not even allowed to shave off his beard. I do, however, want to tell you one of my favorite Jake stories, and I hope he doesn't mind. It's also, I think, rather appropriate, given that Jake has just penned I haven't read it yet, a 286-page profession of unfaith to prove that God does not exist. Jake and I overlapped at the South China Morning Post, and I would like to think that he sometimes reported to me. I was deputy business editor in this and ran the section when the business editor, Simon Pritchard, was away. Jake, of course, was the paper's very well-regarded and entertaining monitor columnist. Jake, however, reports to one person and one person only. That's his wife, Veronica. He made that very clear to us one weekday evening in July 2003 after Simon decided to hold Jake's business column. On the outrageous grounds that a rant about Bishop Joseph Zen did not a business column make. Jake had detected hypocrisy in a Roman Catholic bishop's enthusiasm for democracy, noting that he could, quote, think of another institution aside from the Hong Kong government that appoints its chief executive through a narrowly constituted election committee. Thus spoke Jake about my Holy Father and the College of Cardinals. When Cardinal Zen spoke here in June, I was very, very relieved that Jake decided he would excuse himself from the head table. Upon being told that his column would not run, Jake launched the only industrial action in the 106-year history of the South China Morning Post. He turned off his mobile phone and went walkabout for 3 days while we scrambled to fill his column space. Fortunately for Simon and I, Jake's great mate, Stephen Brown, was then writing for The Standard, and he fed that paper's gossip column a daily update on the Jake strike. Simon and I went into the office every morning. The first thing we did is pick up The Standard's gossip column as we waited anxiously for our star columnist to return. All of which is to say that Jake is a very unique character, a rare talent, and a real asset to this club. Whether ably steering our finance committee or matching wits with that genius David Webb in an entertaining debate for our members, he's provided an immense service to the FCC. We congratulate him on his latest book and look forward to his talk here today. Jake, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. There is a word in journalism which I think my fellow journalists will recognize. It is scooped. What did I have here on the first page of this speech? But a story you may recognize. fellow refugees from the wisdom of Henry Tang. That contentious column to which Tom has just referred was indeed critical of Joseph Zinn, and I indeed went on strike for 3 days, and I was docked 3 days' holiday pay with the South China Morning Post, you never win. And I received for it a stream of how dare you emails. I even had the curate at St. John's shaking his head at me and offering to set me straight. And if you if you pass St. John's at any time at the moment, you will see that offer was withdrawn from me and applied instead to the steeple at St. John's. The scaffolding is up. They're setting it straight again. Well, what had I done? The minor offense, as Tom mentions, was accusing the cardinal of hypocrisy. I couldn't see how the senior representative of so undemocratic an institution as the Vatican was in a position to make persistent complaints about the undemocratic nature of the Hong Kong government. I didn't object to the message, mind you. In fact, I agree with it entirely. But I did find the messenger an odd one. And that was the minor offense, as I say. I'm not the first person in Hong Kong to have called the cardinal a hypocrite. The major offense, however, was telling him that he had better things to do with his time anyway. I said, if you really believe that God came down to earth 2,000 years ago in the form of the person of Jesus Christ and died on the cross to absolve all of us from our sins so that those who recognize this sacrifice may be granted eternal life in heaven, if you really believe that, I said, well, that would be without a doubt, the most pivotal central event of human history, and nothing else that has ever happened before or after would ever be of any much significance to us. Certainly not the relative state of the usage of the ballot box in Hong Kong. But I said to the cardinal, if you would rather preach the ballot box in your church's own message, then do us a favor and take the collar off your neck and put on a jacket and tie instead. As I say, that raised a bit of a storm among Catholics in particular, and if some of them are still annoyed with me for it, well, let me apologize for having singled out the Catholic Church when there are any number of other churches and religions to whom I could have addressed that criticism just as easily. It does, however, lead me to one observation that I think is valid, which is that in matters of unbelief and belief, Catholics lapse. It takes a Protestant to reject. I'm a Protestant, or rather, was one. The product of a Bible-thumping, heavily sermonized, no-shopping-on-Sunday Dutch Reformed sect. And if any of you have any friends from the Netherlands, mention my hometown, Kampen, and the result will be a few chuckles and some comments about black-socked fundamentalist loonies. Out there, you can always tell on a Sunday morning who's who. The believers are all in church, half of them sitting on the side pews fast asleep catching up on last night's. That's all right. The atheists are out in the river fishing. The shops are all closed, the streets are dead empty, and there is no crowd at the fishing spots. Most atheists soon find their way out of town again. I know religion, at least that kind of heavily committed religion, and I'm no longer an adherent to any religion, church, or sect. I am an apostate. I reject. And the book I'm introducing here today, Twelfth Fairy, is essentially my statement of why. It's a 120,000-word retelling of an old fairy tale to boil down to 4 words my basic question to any religion, church, sect, or faith. How do you know? That's my question. How do you really know? Now, I hope you weren't expecting a book entitled China, the Rising Dragon, or China, the Sleeping Tiger Awakes, or anything of that kind. There are already 2 shelves of these on any bookstore in Hong Kong. Equally, I've already put 20 years of working as an investment analyst in this town into a book on investment advice. It's entitled Dr. Doctor, an Investment Analyst on the Couch. And my advice to you in that book is to ask all personal investment advisors the question they least like to hear. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Why do you still bother with me? Think about it. It is a very valid question for investment advisors, and they hate it. I've also already written a book published by Peter Gordon of Chameleon Press, my publisher for 12th Ferry. Peter, stand up. Show yourself. that was a book on the most common theme of my column in the South China Morning Post for many years, the proper interaction of the public and private sectors in the economy. And that book is entitled The Emperor's Old Clothes, and it sets out my thesis that proactive government always gets it wrong. Please, Donald, don't conceive of any brilliant ideas. It's not your forte. Both of those books were largely products of spare hours at the main bar after I'd finished my column. And over the last year, having retired from that column, much of my time at my usual perch down there has been devoted to bringing this latest book, The 12th Ferry, to publication. Now, I've been told that one thing one mustn't do when introducing a work of fiction is give away the plot before the readers have turned the first page. Don't do it, they said. Just don't. Pointless advice. I mean, the plot was already given away more than 100 years ago. On her 16th birthday, the princess shall prick her finger upon a spindle and she shall die. I've had to read the book to my own children. I've had to sing the song. A great big forest grew around. Oh, we all know the story of the Sleeping Beauty. But how many of us believe in fairies? Hands up now. Tooth Fairy, that's mine. I accepted the Tooth Fairy, by the way, because she does exist. I found out. I mean, when I was a kid, I put my tooth under and I got a shiny coin the next day. So that. But the ones that say, I give this child a gift of beauty, I give this child a gift of health, or the Sleeping Beauty, who believes in that kind of fairy? Well, in my retelling of the story, neither does the fairy who supposedly cast the evil spell on the princess. And what implications might that have for the old story and for the religion of Sleeping Beauty Land, where everyone believes in God because there are 12 fairies who can prove God's existence with miraculous divine gifts that they can bestow on the fortunate? Who needs blind faith if you can have proof? See, one of the biggest difficulties I've always had with religion is that they almost tell me I must take it on faith. Just believe. Make a blind leap of faith. And all religions say that. Well, if a blind leap of faith in one direction is going to take me to Christianity, and a blind leap of faith in another direction takes me to Islam, and a blind leap of faith in some third direction takes me somewhere else and who knows where it is, then how can anyone say one is better or one is right, one is truthful, one is not, when it just is all in what random direction I happen blindly to leap? Why can't we have a little proof for a change? Some hard evidence. Just once? Please? And I do not consider this a plea in a trivial cause. Just look at how much of the world of the news today is absorbed in wars that have a direct religious cause or are made worse by willful religious misunderstanding. Blind leaps of faith too easily lead to false beliefs and too easily lead to trouble. In my opinion, all highly organized religions have got elements of falsity in their beliefs, not necessarily in their roots, because there's always an element of truth there, but in the accretions that grow out on those roots from the day those roots are first put out. And in my opinion, the results of this, even with all the claims of charity work and social service put in the balance, are very often bad. But I've endured enough preaching in my own time to know that anyone's appetite for it is easily limited, as yours should be by about now. That's why Twelfth Fairy is not a book of sermons. What I've tried to do here is take my question, how do you know, and set it in an old story in a faraway land, far enough away to talk about what's common to highly organized religions and why it should be wrong or could be wrong. Now, I think you'll like that book, just as a good absorbing read, and I'm particularly pleased that I've had the opportunity to introduce it to you at my favorite club. And if instead of talking about the roots of religious beliefs, you would rather discuss the sorts of things I wrote about in my column, well, I shall tell you right now that I don't believe the Hong Kong-Macau-Zhuhai Bridge will ever be built. That $60 billion to be spent on a railway under the hills is the most wasteful expenditure the Hong Kong government has ever considered. And I'm not a believer in the stock market recovery. But let me say first that if you like that column I used to write for the South China Morning Post, well, I think The Twelfth Fairy is the best thing I've ever written. Thank you. And my fountain pen is obviously waiting out here afterwards for anyone who wishes a signed copy.
Okay, I think this is going to be one of the odder Q&As I've ever hosted up here. Jake is open to take questions about any subject under the sun, whether God, lack thereof, new rail lines, or his past career as a business columnist. So know that, but let's put you on the couch first, Jake. And full disclosure, you're right, I'm a Catholic who did not have the courage to reject, and after a 20-year lapse, I've just started going back to weekly Mass. So this is what you've been doing down in the bar all this time. 286 pages asking other people to prove why they believe. Do you protest too much? Doesn't that suggest a man who's desperately looking for an answer?
That's a very standard response from any person who's, I might describe as religious. And yes, of course it's true. Why bother to write this much if it isn't a matter in which I take an interest? But if you mean protest too much in terms of you really believe, do you not? You're just trying to resist your own beliefs. No, I'm an apostate.
Well, let's carry on here. To the memory of my father, who did not approve of apostasy, but did understand it. You want to just tell us about growing up and family's beliefs?
My father was the headmaster of a Christian private school in the Black Sock fundamentalist tradition. If he ever entertained apostasy in the hearing of any of his members of his church, he would not long have had that job. And with 9 children to maintain, that would have been somewhat of a difficulty. I said already, I grew up in what was a very strongly Protestant sect.
This was and in Holland or Canada?
Holland, and then you're in Canada where the same group existed. And I do think it is true when I say about Catholics lapse, Protestants reject, because Protestantism always was a rejection. And Catholicism, I think, too easily says, well, let's not bother with it. We'll just get around this and let's not trouble ourselves too much.
I was about to say, where's Father Hogan when you need him? First here, please, and we'll work our way left.
Jake. It strikes me that people really need something to believe in. So if they're not going to believe in religion, what are they going to believe in?
Bonnie, will you answer that one for me? Well, people used to believe in Zeus, and Athena, around the Mediterranean at least, and all the gods of the panoply of Olympus. Would we do that today? The kinds of religions that rose over the last 2,000 years were a definite advance on the animal practices, or people standing around a campfire making rootless chants. We progress. And I don't know what that understanding of what we may call God comes to in the future, but I think we make a mistake when we try to define God.
David.
As you give such rich opportunities to ask the pointed questions, I'm not sure where to start. 2,000 years ago, there was neither Catholic nor Protestant church, so obviously you're saying progress. Well, all right, let that one go. I do compliment you on having chosen A Den of Iniquity to write your book. Obviously, it shortens the route to hell. And I suppose that, you know, the next step is to start your own religion. That's been done before, but obviously you know enough about it and how profitable it can be that this should be high on your agenda. But I think I'll come down to the one question would be, do you believe that there is any kind of a dampening effect on the nastier bits of human behavior because of organized religion having a large political role for so many centuries?
I take you, first of all, your points about neither Protestantism nor Catholicism existed 2,000 years ago. They were inherent even in the beliefs at that time. It was a split that I think became inevitable. But leaving that aside, I do not think that religion can be seen as taken into the balance sheet as being either good or bad on that basis. I think that wars caused by religion are as bad as wars caused by any other cause, and sometimes worse. And we can go through the whole of the history of warfare or the history of any misery that men and humans inflict on other humans right throughout history and find, I think, that that is generally true, that you could put some things in the balance sheet in favor, but easily as many, and I think more sometimes, against.
There's a question against the wall, and then we'll come back to the front.
Is it true, the rumor I hear, that the subject of the next book will be the Jack Vanderkamp version of Animal Farm?
I shall never claim to be more equal than others. The subject of the next book, because I like the idea of taking fairy tales and twisting them around, will be Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Wait to see what I make of that one.
In front, please.
I recently saw a cartoon, and it could have been Sarkozy and the Seven Dwarves for a photo opportunity. Jake, would you agree that whatever progress has been made in the last two millennia has been because of the absence of religion?
I think that's very hard when you're to really put in. In some ways, it must be. Some of the scientific progress results from a level of inquiry that no religion really can tolerate all that much. And to that extent, it has to be true. But our lives, all of our lives, are really still, at least for those of us with European roots or even Middle Eastern roots, are so entirely wrapped up in religious ethics that it's pretty hard to separate that out yet. At a range of 1,000 years from now, perhaps. But clearly, scientific effort requires inquiry, which religion does not encourage.
It's one reason why science left Italy forever and went to Northern Europe and England.
Well, at this point we can get on to the writings of Jared Diamond and where the origins of temporary European wealth and intellectual supremacy might have come from, and I find him one of the best authorities I've ever read on that subject, and he certainly differs on that. Far more to do with matters of geography, climate, and so forth. I'm not going to hazard an opinion on that. That's a contention that it'll be long before it's settled. Not entirely. If it was a matter of faith alone, people wouldn't have anything in which to argue the point. There is some evidence to adduce on an argument of that kind.
CP, and then back to David.
CP, I can hear you.
We can hear you.
This question should really be directed at a Brit, but since you're on the subject and as a Canadian Dutch, you should do. What is it in the human psyche that makes us spell God into dot when spelled backwards?
Sorry, I missed that. Sorry, CP, I missed that. I missed that.
What is it in the human psyche that makes us spell God into dog when spelled backwards?
It can't be a human psyche. It's got to be the English. It's got to be the English language one alone. But if you wish to raise the point, I'll raise one of my quibbles. Why are typhoons these days not called Kate or Pete or Tom and things that we can recognize and instead given words that I can't pronounce?
Sorry, before we go back to David, I just want to ask my own second question. Aren't you making a really big mistake here? Is that your assumption is that faith is easy and the point is it's very, very difficult?
No.
And you're giving up because it's not easy. And you look at everybody else who has it and say, how is it so easy for you? Not realizing it's pretty hard.
Faith in itself is neither easy nor hard. It's a matter of stating a belief and ascribing to that belief and trying to counter your doubts in that belief, if you should choose. The hardness of any faith or any belief of that kind is living up to the principles you espouse. And that doesn't have to be the kind of difficulty that only someone who is religious need feel. Anyone who has any faith or any goal or any commitment can have that, can experience that kind of difficulty.
David, and I think Jake's daughter should ask the next question.
So while you're on the spot, how exactly did you meet my mother? And then...
It was an act of God.
And then on the more sort of minor question that I want to know, are human rights values for a godless age? And assuming that they are values for a godless age, does human rights have the capacity to start wars in the way religion does?
Could you tell us where you work? I'm serious. Could you please tell us where you've just started working?
I shall answer Tom's question for Jessica, and now works with the United Nations Development Program and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And her first question to me, not quite fair, since she organized our 25th anniversary on the Posada Santiago in Macau 2 years ago, in part to make me answer that question, that first question again, and didn't answer at that time. So she puts me on the spot once more. We met at the South China Morning Post when we were there several 25, 30 years ago. Are human rights, say again, the problem about a human right that I've always had is I can understand human privilege, I can understand human obligations, but human rights assumes a human obligation. If you say that everyone has the right to education, then equally some other set of humans is obligated to provide that education. By what authority is that right or obligation assigned? In order to speak really strongly about rights, absolute rights in any case, you would probably need a religious basis, not a humanist one. I think it may be a weakness of atheism, but there is nonetheless. Right implies a moral obligation. Who assigns it? If you don't have God assign it in some way, then it hardly can exist. You see, my point, I oppose I am opposed. I have my doubts, strong doubts, about organized religions because of the accretions of faith that come onto organized religions. I think that there's some major faults in Catholicism for just that sort of reason. Too many accretions over 2,000 years. I don't deny the existence of God. I simply say, don't ever try to define it.
This is fun. Let's go back to this table and then David again.
I'm certain that I'll haven't heard the last of that at dinner table tonight.
I think, yeah, pretty certain. It's kind of a question to you, Jacob, but as well as to Tom, because I thought Tom's point about believing it being harder than not believing, I think, isn't it at a more fundamental level? If you don't believe in a third party or a religion, by default you have to believe in yourself. Isn't that harder than believing in a religion? Because you've got nowhere to go with it. You know, you can't blame someone else. You can only there's only you.
You thought you had me on the spot, Tom. You're on the spot now.
Sorry, was that question directed at me? No way. No. No. His point, you have to answer that question.
I was
question.
Kind of glancing it off of Jake onto you.
Yes,
I think that Jake could get involved in that.
Oh, because, right, I'm trying to find my way back to God because I can't just believe in myself. All right, look, I'll this comes as a surprise. I'll answer it honestly, but very quickly. When you're 40 years old and you're a bachelor, and you don't have kids, you're not sure, you think, do you really want the rest of your life to be about yourself? Now you have to answer that, right? because it's not just about myself. Anyway,
I have another question.
Sure.
Which is harder, gravity or levitation?
Levitation appears more difficult. Yes, thank you. Wendy.
Either of you.
Sorry.
What is wrong with having an absolute belief in yourself that you can do, you make it happen, that there isn't... I mean, I know you're the higher power because you are the president. But, you know, what is wrong with that?
I would say, first of all, that Tom may consider himself the highest power as being president. I always thought that the treasurer, which is the position I hold, as real greater authority.
I fully agree with that, as we experienced earlier this week.
Wendy, it's more of a comment you make than a question, as you must realize.
I'm a banker, so I can be forgiven. I hope. If I understood you properly, it is religion you reject, not God.
Yes.
And so then the question that follows on to that, so how do you approach God? How do you think about God? How do you interact with God? Or do you?
If you look at the stars at night directly, you won't see them. It's the way your eyes operate, that the cells, the light-receiving cells that are sensitive, really sensitive to low light, are around the periphery, not in the center of your eye. You must notice that before. See a faint star, look off to the side. And I think much is the same, and it's true, when you start to ask questions of religion of that kind. You recognize, by the time you try to look directly, you don't see your way anymore. Don't try to define God. You recognize, leave it. It's when you start to say, and because God is there, therefore there must be sin. And because sin is there, there must be this. And before you know it, you've got Islam, you've got Christianity, you've got many things, and thousands of accretions, and books, and temples, and priests, and everything grow on all this structure, until, like the gods of Mount Olympus, it just becomes silly and has to crumble. That doesn't get rid of God, it just gets rid of the accretions.
David?
First of all, I have to say congratulations on having had no questions on any other subject. I think this is amazing. But, you know, your beef is with organized religion. How about disorganized? And I mean anything except Middle Eastern origin religions. Buddhism, Hinduism, Zen, Confucianism, Taoism. Highly disorganized and a whole different kettle of fish. Where do they fit in your view of the world?
They don't. I mean, look, I'm a product of European civilization. I am not here commenting that much on religions like Buddhism, like Taoism. I think the kind of comments I make can apply to Hinduism still, but not Buddhism that much, not Taoism that much. They are very unstructured beliefs. I accept that. To the extent that they start adding any kind of accretions on them, I think you're in trouble once again. Certainly by the time you get down to a Tinhao temple and you start to wonder, well, where did this originate and what do we have going here? Then I think you're once again in that trouble of accretions that have built on some basic faith that should have just been left alone.
Right.
Jake, it's a follow-on a little bit to the previous question, but you talk about the belief in religion. What about philosophy? What about politics? They imply a certain form of belief too. Does the same criteria that you've applied in your book apply to them?
Of course, because there are many kinds of things that many kinds of beliefs that are very quasi-religious. Maoism, great. Nazism. Any kind of faith that, any kind of belief that soon begins to doubt intellectual inquiry or scorn intellectual inquiry, very soon takes on the characteristic of an organized religion, and it applies just as equally to all of those.
Bonnie.
Jake, it strikes me that your accretions are leading to the word intolerance. Is that what is really bothering you, that all of these different sects in religion have created such intolerance?
Intolerance is one of the things that these accretions come to, but they also come to beliefs that I think are pointless. And I can think of the sort of silly things that this very Protestant fundamentalist sect that I had in was part of in Holland, or grew up and around on, believed or inflicted on people. The biggest problem, I think, with religions of that kind is not so much intolerance, is that they become priest-ridden, that poor people have got another burden to take a great deal of time and income from them. The sort of criticisms that are quickly made of, let's say, traditionally in Spain, of Roman Catholicism as it became in Spain, heavily priest-ridden. And that's not just against Catholicism, that is equally as much against Protestantism, which does the same. What I'm doing in this book is trying to keep it as simple as I say I would have my own belief in God. Take a religion that says we have proof and now question it. Have the center of that proof question it and say, how do you know? How do you know? Not how do we put it back. We just start with how do you know in the first place. Not for me.
Jake, if you're such a crusty SOB, although I think we're really just discovering you're kind of a big softy, and correct me if my information's wrong, you never told me, but I think it's right. Why do you give a percentage of your income every year to charity?
I do. I think it's something that's just right to do. I can't put it past that, and if you want to call that a religious belief, it's one of those ones that I say is should not be examined. One just does. You know, there's an obligation there. And I really want to stress that point. You do not have, you can quite easily believe in God without having to define on every single occasion what that need mean to you. when you start going down that route, you start building churches and you start going off the rails.
We can take one last question on this subject. Marty?
Just briefly getting back to your column, probably the finest column you ever did was illustrated by the mosquito in your bedroom. Not many, most bankers would remember this column. But it strikes me that what sort of fairy story doesn't have illustrations? And maybe you could have recycled some of the graphs from your column to give your book a bit more oomph.
The column Marty refers to was me sitting at 5:30 with the first call likely to come at 6:15 from the newsroom. We were just wondering, 45 minutes to go, not a thought in my head about what I would contribute for that day. And someone said, why don't you do a chart on mosquitoes? So I did one at random that had a line going at the bottom at number one and then went to 400 briefly and spiked back down to one. And at the top of the spike, I put in something that said, my bedroom. At the bottom, it said, everywhere else. And then made a complaint about mosquitoes in Hong Kong. That was a great relief. That one was done in half an hour. I didn't get that call after all. No, Marty, not a single chart.
Jake, I think maybe just a good way to wrap this up, because I think everyone's probably pretty curious, is now that you've got nothing to do down there but twiddle your thumbs and drink, do you miss writing that column? Or do you think there's a possibility you could go back to regular column writing in any capacity?
There might be. I certainly pick up the newspaper sometime, and there's an obvious one to be told, an obvious have a go at someone, and I've given my weapons away. but not immediately. And if it isn't immediately a column, as I say, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves later on.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that. You probably weren't either. But it was fun. Please join me in thanking Jake. And as always, we have the normal gift. We have an invitation for 9:30 Cathedral Mass this Sunday. I'll be waiting for you at the front door. In fact, come a bit earlier so we can go to confession first.
For two books at the cathedral door, for many more, the confession. I should be sitting over here, and if any of you would you like to see one of these copies autographed, please do come along. If you don't, sorry to put you on the spot.